WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven and the Wyand Cimbali Group.
Welcome, everybody. What a great evening. And I'm so thrilled and honored to be sitting up here with Elizabeth Gilbert. And, well, let's get started.
Let's roll.
All right. Can I start with an olé?
Thank you.
Has everybody seen the TED Talk, right? Have you guys seen the TED Talk? All right. So one of the worries that Elizabeth had earlier on was whether her creative spirit would find her again. And I think after reading this book, certainly that happened.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It was beautiful.
I appreciate it, Trevor.
All right. So it's a long book and very dense, and I found it very satisfying. It was like a yummy, delicious, long dinner, and I felt very full at the end. So how long did it take you to research this book? So dense.
Yeah, it took. I have a friend who said it's like eating one of those croissants that's so light and flaky you don't realize that it has three sticks of butter in it.
Exactly.
That's what I'm hoping it comes across in the book. It took me about 3 years to research it, which included researching the history of botany in the late 18th, early 19th century, abolition, missionary life, pornography of the era, which was very important to the book, thank goodness.
That was interesting, that part. I liked it.
All, you know, just every aspect that I possibly could of that era, and then traveling to Kew Gardens in London to look at Darwin's Herbarium, to go to the Hortus Botanical Gardens in Amsterdam, one of the early pharmaceutical gardens in the world, and of course to French Polynesia to make sure that the Tahitian part of the book was right, because, you know, that's the sacrifice we make for our art. Yeah.
Yes, that's very difficult to
go
it
is.
To such
Thank
tough
you for
places.
Your sympathy.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Well, okay, so, you know, one of the things that I was impressed about this book was the depth of Alma, and she was such a fascinating character. She's not your average heroine by any means. How did she come to you?
You know, I knew I wanted to write about a woman. I knew I wanted to write about a scientist. I thought that that would be an interesting creative encounter for me because I'm very much not a scientist. Alma is empirical. She's fact-driven. Her world is black and white. She's always trying to hunt down the code behind everything. I am spiritual, flaky, slipshod, airy. I'm everything that she isn't. So it was kind of cool to step into her very sensible shoes and become a person with a very different mind than my own. And as it turned out, botany was really the only plausible science that I could place her in the 19th century because botany was the only science that women were sort of welcomed into on account of flowers, women, feminine. And there were a number of really interesting 19th century botanists whose lives I drew upon to create Alma. What I discovered when I researched them, it's a broad generality, but it kind of works for our subject here, is that they tended to share three characteristics in common, the actual prominent female botanists of the day. They were either the daughters or the wives of significant men of science. They tended to be independently wealthy, and they tended to be either spinsters or childless. And so it was out of that model that Alma started to be formed, a woman who is all three of those things.
Now, did you have to wrestle with her, or did she come naturally? Was this a genius moment and where you felt comfortable with her?
You know, I don't wrestle with anybody. You know, I'm not a fighter, and I think I don't even fight with my work. I wouldn't even wrestle with a mugger, probably. You know, like I'm a cooperator. You know, I would just be like, what is it that, you know, what are we? Let's talk about this. You know,
let's get this down, Alma.
Surely we can come to some kind of a compromise here. And I spend a lot of time. You know, my feeling generally in life is that anything that you fight fights you back. So I don't fight against creativity. I try to work with it. I think it's a really beautiful collaboration. I think ultimately my definition of creativity is that it's a collaboration between a human being and the mystery of inspiration. And the mystery of inspiration we will never solve. And it's also very rare. You know, inspiration to me is kind of like the creative equivalent of infatuation. It's sexy, and it's fleeting, and it's magnificent, and we all want to live in that all the time. For me, the difference between inspiration and a lifetime of creativity is like the difference between a one-night stand and a 30-year marriage. You know,
I love that.
And so my job as somebody who wants to be married to creativity is to show up every day and do the daily work, you know, and to celebrate the daily work, not as boring, but as devotional. Mm-hmm. You know, so Alma, I mostly just asked her questions, you know, and I would say to her, what do you want people to know about you? What do you want, lead me? Where do you want me to take this story? What, you know, what do you want us to do here? And somehow that seems to work better for me than fighting.
Well, I felt while I was reading it that you really had high regard for her, that you really cared about her.
Yeah.
And that you really connected with her. Is there parts of Alma in you?
Well, sure, but there's parts of me in every character in this book because I wrote it, so my DNA is embedded in everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's parts of Alma. I mean, there's certainly very big differences between me and Alma as well. You know, primary of which I think is that I'm a very social creature, and she never quite mastered that. You know, she's got a sort of awkwardness around people that I've never had, and of course her science mind versus my arty mind. But what we share, I think, is a devotion toward a vocation. Mm-hmm. And I feel like one of the things I really wanted this novel to be is the celebration of a woman who loves her work, who loves her vocation. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like that's a story we just don't see told very often, and we don't see honored very often. And as a woman whose life has been, like, really created by my work and then oftentimes saved by my work, I have such regard for the idea that you find something to do that you love and you commit yourself to it for your entire life. And that's where she and I are kind of soul twins. Although like she would hate the word soul twins.
She would. It's not scientific enough. Not enough. All right, well, so I was going to ask you which character was the most difficult, but since it feels like it's sort of they come to you in this nice non-wrestling way, is that a pertinent question?
You know, it's funny. The character who I felt like I didn't know when I began writing the book, because I felt like I spent so much time. I mean, the other thing I should tell you is that I'm a real worker. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about creative inspiration, I want to make very clear that I have high regard for it, and I think it's exciting, and I think it's important. But I'm much more really of the Thomas Edison school of 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. You know,
you work hard.
I work really hard, and I work really diligently, and the inspiration comes through the cracks in that work, you know. And so by the time I sat down to write this book, I had 5 shoeboxes filled with index cards of notes from 3 years of research. I had a 70-page long outline. Mm-hmm. I knew who every character was. I knew every plot point. It was really, I left very little to chance. Mm-hmm. That said, there was this one character, the missionary, the Reverend Francis Wells. That was tricky for me because I wanted him to be a very sympathetic character, and yet it's difficult to read the history of the Christian missions of the 19th century and not sort of be like, guys, stop, you know.
I did. I felt terrible for
their culture. Stop telling those children they're not allowed to speak their native tongue. You know, like, all, you know, you're watching them do all this stuff, and even though they were doing it from the goodness of their hearts, they were doing a lot of damage often when they made places.
That was clear.
So it was tricky for me to find out how to make him both plausible as a missionary, but also very deeply lovable as a person. So that was a little bit of effort. And so
I think
decided,
you accomplished it.
Well, thanks.
I felt connected to him. I thought he was a lovely person, and he met well, as best he could.
As he said himself, my wife says I'm a better Christian than I am a missionary. I just had him be really bad at converting people and really good at loving them. And so I wanted him to be sort of the Christian heart of the book in the way that I could respect and regard.
Now, I just had to imagine halfway through this book that you became obsessed with moss.
I did, and I hope the readers will, too. It's worthy of obsession. You know, moss did not get to be the oldest plant on Earth by being stupid and boring. You know, it's a really interesting substance. And I wanted Alma to study moss because I needed her to have something that she could realistically devote her life to that was within walking distance of her house and that was also varied enough that she wouldn't have to go to Madagascar or to the Galapagos like the great male explorers of the day in order to investigate it. Something, and I also felt like there was something symbolic about the fact that moss is overlooked and underfoot, and that is, I think, what many women's lives have been.
Exactly.
And also that it's tiny and detailed, like the arts that women have always done. It's kind of like the needlework of the botanical world. The things that women have always made in order to not go mad. And moss was what Alma studied in order to not go mad.
Yeah. Well, just thinking about what she did to study moss, which went years and years, 50, 60 years. So there's a theme of time in the book. Can you tell us about time? Because there's different types of time.
Yeah, Alma falls into this theory of these different sorts of time, and I've always been sort of interested in this as well. That, and she talks about it begins for her with geological time. You mm-hmm. know, she's a scientist, and at that moment in history, fossils were being discovered, and there was a dawning realization that the oceans and the land masses were not in the same place they had always been. Mm-hmm. People were trying to work that out, and there was this sort of growing revelation that the Earth was a good deal older than we had thought it was, mm-hmm. maybe even a fantastically amount older than we thought it was. So she's sort of focused on this idea of very slow geological time. And then the deepest time is what she calls divine time, which is the time that God lives in, which is a kind of eternal stasis that is unknowable to a human being. She has no interest in studying it because she doesn't believe it can be cracked. but she knows it's out there, right? And that's like the slowest time there is. And then there's geological time. And then there's moss time. And moss time is the amount of time it takes a bed of moss to transform the environment that it's in. Moss very slowly eats rock and breaks it down. And so moss time is faster than geological time. Moss can do in 1,000 years what stone can't do in 10,000, 100,000 years. But it's still achingly slow. And then at the very bottom of the level is the thing she calls human time. And human time is the snap of the finger that's a human life. And she becomes keenly aware of this in her middle age because she knows she doesn't have enough years to study the moss that she wants to understand and the geology that she wants to understand. And she envies the moss their pace. And she says, if they knew how short my time was here, it would be so sad for me. But she only has a few decades to try to capture their movement and their evolution. And there's a sort of pain that I've always felt about that as well. I've always been, even as a child, I think I've always been keenly aware of how short our time is here, and probably why I am so stressfully trying to achieve as much as I possibly can in that time rather than just enjoying it, which is what other people might tell me to do.
Well, this is all good, though, because you're creating beautiful things, and we get to learn from these things, too. And thanks. I've learned a lot about moss just reading this book. So
it is a 500-page novel about moss. It's not really only about that. Don't worry, guys.
Got to read it.
Goes down easy. Goes down real easy.
And of course,
Butter croissant.
Yeah. So, and then there's, of course, the huge tension between evolution and Darwinism, which she is in sort of lockstep with Darwin coming up with the theory, but also with human connection and self-sacrifice, or the prudence problem. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the things that, Alma, one of the things I should back up and say that I found it fascinating and educational to learn that the word evolution and the idea of evolution had been around for a good 70 years before Darwin ever wrote Origin of Species. I did not know that. I thought that evolution got dropped spilled meal in front of everybody as soon as Darwin published. But everybody who was anybody in the scientific world all through the 19th century had been pondering this question and this puzzle. They knew that species were transmuting. They knew that the geological record showed that the world was older than they thought. They knew that things were changing. They just didn't know the mechanism. And what Darwin did was he brought forth the mechanism, and that is the theory of competitive alteration and survival of the fittest. And Alma's working on that too, as are a bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. So she's working on that question from the moss fields, and she's gleaning the same conclusions. She's kind of circling the same idea, that there seems to be this process by which there are limited resources in too many organisms, and the ones that make it and the species that make it are the ones that can sort of get to those resources. All of which points to the idea of tremendous competition and even violence in the world.
Yes.
And in that theory, she simply cannot solve the question of how you then account for human altruism and self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And she holds back a lot of her writings on this because she can't solve that question. And she's such a perfectionist that she wants to make sure that she gets that right. And it's a question that still hasn't been solved. We still don't have universal scientific explanation for why somebody would give their life to another person before they had even passed on their genetic code. You know, that doesn't make sense in the evolutionary standpoint. And so there's this little crack in the theory that that we still haven't quite mastered.
Well, I do address that in my book, and just to put a quick plug in, but I do believe it's survival.
November. Available in all fine bookstores.
Right. but the survival of the most connected, I actually believe, that we really cannot live alone in.
It's
funny you should say that, because I spoke, I did a lot of research with a very prominent female moss scientist who's kind of a rock star hero of mine. It took me 2 years to get up the nerve to write her a letter to ask if I could come and visit her. And I like inflated her in my mind to such an, I thought she was like Bono at that point, and I thought she was going to be like, like when I went to her farmhouse in upstate New York, and I thought there must be lines of people here wanting to visit Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer and talk to her about moss evolution, you know, because she just had become so huge in my mind. But she spoke about how, you know, moss, there is really no such thing as a moss. You know, one moss is a dead moss. It's a colony. And she talks about the ways that they, that even there's altruism within the moss community, where she has studied how a certain group of mosses will, you know, will sacrifice themselves on the edges and the perimeter so that the interior of the colony can get water. You know, so even there in the natural world, you know, without, you know, without collaboration, we don't last long.
There you go. So another of the themes is this sort of communication across time and space, emotionally, spiritually. And, of course, we have Ambrose Pike and Alma. And they communicate, but maybe miscommunicate a little bit.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Well, Alma is a very rational and grounded person who does what all rational, grounded people do. She falls in love with the first magnetic, artistic, irrational airy person that she meets. I'm sure that that's never happened to anybody in this audience. There is nothing more attractive than somebody whose feet do not touch the ground.
Right.
And Alma falls prey to that. And she and he is not a he's a lovely person. Mm-hmm. His name is Ambrose Pike, and he's a painter of orchids, and a beautiful man and a transcendental soul who really doesn't want to be a person. He wants to be a spirit.
Yeah.
And very much believes in spiritual communication. And something occurs between them at some point in the novel, which I will always leave to the reader to decide what exactly that was. But in that moment, they both believe that they have heard something.
Mm-hmm.
They have misheard. and I think it's...
They connected.
Yeah. But I think that that's one of the great sort of tragedies and trials of human love is that sometimes even in those moments of greatest perceived intimacy, we can be so wrong about what's going on in the other person's mind. Just so terribly, terribly wrong. And neither one of them had ever been particularly taught how to transcend that. And so they were relying on kind of signals and notions rather than on anything more solid and real.
Mm-hmm. Well, it did feel very believable to me. I mean, just imagining how people spoke in the Victorian times, early Victorian times, really, and how they would communicate and how you would talk about love without having really any language. So in a way, it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, and forget about language, about sex.
Right.
You know, and I mean, this was an era. It was the other thing I found very interesting was my character is very sexual, and I wanted her to be because I wanted to tell the entire life of a woman, birth to death, and that includes sexuality. And I wanted that, and because I'm a contemporary writer, although it feels like a 19th century book, I'm writing from a contemporary standpoint, so I can do what the Brontes could only insinuate.
Imagine.
You know, and I can sort of express what they could only sort of wink at. And I wanted to really fully investigate that because I also think that having read Our Proper Jane Austen for so many years, we do forget that these people had bodies. They weren't just heads on top of corseted dresses, you know? They had, and we did not invent sexual desire in the 20th century as much as we like to think that we did. It's not new, and so I wanted to explore that with Alma. But she was at a tough moment for that. Her father was a creature from the era of the Age of Enlightenment, which was a much more sexually open era than what came after it. And it was really interesting for me to see how, in the late 1780s, there was this idea that people like each other's bodies. I mean, if you read Ben Franklin, he's a randy guy, and his assumption is that women are too.
Yeah.
You know, and he's really comfortable with the fact that women are into this, and I'm into this, and you know, like let's check this out. I mean, he lived in France a long time too, so that helped. you know, but you know, he had sort of progressive ideas, but that was not atypical of the time. And then you go 100 years later, 75 years later, and everything has been locked down. And there's not only this idea that this must never be spoken of, it must never be written of, it must never be admitted to. There was also this new idea that women hated it. And you see these heartbreaking letters that young Victorian men wrote to their brides-to-be, these like tear-stained letters saying, "I'm so sorry in advance for the horror that I'm about to inflict on you."
Oh, dear.
You know, because the assumption was they really hate it. You know, it's awful. It's awful for them. And so to be a woman in that time who was like, "I'm kind of interested in this," would have been a really difficult thing to be. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to sort of set Alma in contrast to that and see how she was going to manage that.
Although, and this is a spoiler alert, so if anybody hasn't fully read the
just
book...
Just go la, la, la.
Cover your ears. So she didn't really get very much action.
No. Action is a very 19th century term,
yeah.
Trevor. she doesn't.
I kind of felt badly for her, and I was sort of hoping, you know,
I know,
she would get a little...
I know. Well, she got a little something, but we're not going to... we're not going to go too far into that. No, and the reason for that is because I wanted to write a very realistic story, and sometimes people don't get everything they want, you know? And I feel like I wanted to push very hard also in this novel against the only two endings that women ever got in 19th century novels, and in most contemporary stories too, may I say, which is you have the happy ending, which is that you're married to Mr. Darcy, and you're living on a grand estate, or you know, or marriage, you know, good marriage.
There's a white horse in there too.
There's somebody, some guy shows up, and it's great. Or you have the tragic ending, and you're under the wheels of the train, like poor Anna Karenina, right? You're ruined. You know, and there are lots of examples of both of those, and I get it because they're both very dramatic endings. One is the, you know, even in Shakespeare, there's always, the comic endings always have end in marriage, the tragic endings always end in death. And generally speaking, though, when it comes to women's lives, it seems like the plot line you get is that you were either rescued by a man or you were ruined by a man. Mm-hmm. And the reality of women's lives then and now is a lot more complicated than that. And I think that most of us have had moments where we thought, hoped, dreamed that we were being rescued by a man, and maybe it didn't quite turn out. And most of us have had very dark moments where we feared, dreaded that we were going to be ruined by a man, and maybe that didn't quite turn out either, right? Most of us live in the wide medium, which is that you probably didn't necessarily get everything you wanted, but you probably along the way got a lot of things that you did not expect. And certainly the women who I admire and who I base my life on and who I based Alma's life on are women who have a tremendous capacity for being resilient in the face of disappointment. I find that to be the most interesting thing about women, and that they are neither rescued nor ruined. They manage somehow in the midst of their lives to create their own reality, and they are able, after the end of a very long life that's filled with both love and disappointment, and pain and joy, to look back and say, that was a really interesting thing, being alive. You know, glad I did that. You know, like, cool. You know, like, and that's how I feel about Alma, is that by the end of the novel, she's able to look back on this very long life, and we've been with her through every step of it. And she's able to say, that was fantastically interesting. And I think interesting is what you strive for, ultimately, above all.
I love that. Interesting women. So how has your love life affected your writing?
Well...
just to put it out there.
Well, it certainly affected Eat, Pray, Love, yes. As anybody who's got $10 to buy that paperback can attest. It affected it negatively and positively. I mean, it shaped all of it. And, you know, I spent a lot of my life chasing the boys, and they show up in all kinds of ways in my writing. This novel has a very special tone to it, I think, because of something that occurred. I am married to Javier Bardem. You guys know that, right?
I knew that.
And we live in New Jersey, which is where you would live if you could live anywhere, right? I did get my Brazilian guy to leave Bali and move to Jersey. Yes! And it's a very happy marriage. It's a very sweet marriage. and very lovely, and we're very grateful. We spend a lot of time just being grateful, having been through things that are not sweet and easy. This is nice. We're like, this is good, you know. And I tend to be, when I'm writing, I tend to need quite a bit of isolation, and I've never been able to write in my home, whatever my home may have been. Mm-hmm. I've always had to go out, whether it was to a public private space like a library, to an artist retreat, just have to go away. And this novel I wrote at home. It was the first book I ever wrote at home.
Nice.
And not only did I write it at home, but every evening my husband would come upstairs with a glass of wine, and he would listen to me read what I had written that day. And it started kind of accidentally. I finished the introduction. I said, "Do you want to hear this?" And he came up, and I read it to him. And he said, "What happens? What happens?" So the next night he came up, and I read him the next piece. And I wrote it in one, you know, I never stopped once I started. So it was as though I were writing a Victorian serialized novel, but I was writing it for one person, and I was writing it every day, so that I would always leave off at the end of a moment in the book, and then he would say, what? So I had that sense as I was writing that I need to bring him the story tomorrow. And so while I was writing, I was delighting him also, which I hope is in the feeling of the book.
And it also collaboration
keeps the book going, because while I was reading it to him, if I saw, he's so loving and polite, but if I saw the eyes glaze over, I would like in the margin, I'd be like, cut this page, you know, like cut this page. Like I could just see where I was losing him as a reader, you know? So it keeps, that's why it's not a 1500 page book. It's only a 500. So you all have him to thank for that.
You can feel that loving collaboration come throughout the book. It really feels good.
I hope so.
Reading that book. And it is such it's just a huge shift from Ypres Love. And do you feel good about that?
I feel great about that, at the same time as not ever, ever wanting to turn my back on Ypres Love. Mm. You know, I've read some reviews. It's very funny to me, like the approval and disapproval matrix in the literary world. You know, like I was really on the good side for a long time when I was beginning my writing career, and I wrote literary fiction. My first book was a collection of short stories and then a novel, and they gave me the National Book Award nomination for my big biography about a man's journey. And then my next book I wrote was about a woman's journey, and then they just dumped me into the chick lit. That they were like, "Oh, you know, how could you possibly write about emotional life and spirituality and self-improvement and all that stuff?" Like, I really disappointed them. Like, that's the feeling. I cannot express how little I care, first of all. But I, you know, it's amusing for me to watch. It's yes. amusing for me to watch me go from, like, you know, we approve of you, to, oh, honey, no, you can't talk about that. And then I came back with this novel, and to read the reviews, I just go, you guys think I did this for you, you know, because they're so approving again now. They're like, oh, thank goodness she's put all that behind her, and now she's writing serious literature again. And I'm like, if you guys think I've put any of that behind me, you are so out of your minds, because I am so still on that flaky train, man. I am like, you know, I am so still all up in that stuff. And if you come to my Facebook page, you're going to hate me all over again, because I'm like all about like empowerment and transformation and, you know, all of this stuff. And so I'll read, like, there was a review on NPR the other day, and it was so loving at the same time as, like, a lot of reviews needing, the person needed, I guess, out of, I don't know, their own fear or whatever, to make clear that, don't worry, I can't stand Eat, Pray, Love Elizabeth Gilbert, but you will love this book because it's actually a really good book. You know, and I just thought, why do you even have to do that? And also, don't you have other parts of you? You know, like, aren't you made up of many things, like all of us? And don't, you know, and this is the part of me who wants to write novels like this. But the other part of me is still very, very much there. And actually sneaks into this novel in a lot of ways.
The flaky one?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I'm far more Ambrose than I am Alma.
Oh.
You know, so I'm in there, you know, like, I'm in there in other ways, too. So I just find it so funny, like, what you're allowed to talk about and what you're not allowed to talk about. I'm just going to talk about whatever I feel like talking about, basically.
So have you started thinking about our next project?
Yeah, I'm always thinking about it. And it's funny, there's two that are in my mind, and they're sort of having a ping-pong match. And that ping-pong match has been going on for about 6 months, and I'm watching Mm-hmm. I'm watching it. And it's not time for me to write yet. It's time for me to, this is my moment for bringing Alma into the world and for doing this sort of thing. But I know that, you know, in about 6 months, it'll be time for me to start. And then I'm going to have a little talking to with them. You know, I end up talking a lot to my work. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to have to say to them, you guys have to decide which one of you is coming first. Mm-hmm. Is it the novel or is it the nonfiction book? You're going to have to work this out among yourselves.
Now, is this the corner of the room that you mentioned in the TED Talk? You have to go to that corner
Okay. Guys, you know, like, and I'm not going to settle this for you. That's what I tell them all the time. It's sort of parental also. Uh-huh. The one of you who wants to be born first is going to have to really step up, or the one of you who's willing to wait is going to have to back off. But I'm only doing one at a time.
So going back to you, are we feeling that, you know, sort of tough place of the creative genius and feeling upset or worried or depressed or anything? Because you don't appear to be. It doesn't seem like you're wrestling with that. You look pretty happy and comfortable.
Pretty happy, pretty comfortable. Good. You know, I mean, I'll tell you this. I feel like I will always be what's the word that I am? I will always be fundamentalist on this. I will always be challenging the idea that we must be at war with our work. Mm. I will always be challenging that. Mm-hmm. And I challenge that because I've struggled with work and I've cooperated with work and I've seen which way works better. And I also really, truly have come to believe that the world is... and this is the stuff that the New York Times writers who like me right now don't want to hear me saying, but I'm going to say it anyway, that the world is constantly being enswirled and encircled by creative ideas that want to be made manifest. And the only way they can be made manifest is through collaboration with a human being. So they send you these little jolts of inspiration. They throw curious little coincidences in front of you. They try to get your attention. They ask you, are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? You know, they want to know if you're going to make them be born. And when you choose to accept those invitations, mm-hmm. then you have a commitment to honor that, you know, and to show up for it. Creative ideas have nothing to gain by tormenting you. Mm-hmm. They only want to be born. I guarantee you, they are trying to help you. They really are. They're trying to help you make them come through. If there are obstacles, if there are torments, if there are dark nights of the soul, that's you. That's not it, right? And what I feel like happens when we do our thrashing dark night of the soul in the artist studio is that the creative idea is just sitting on the cot in the corner watching, like, just let me know when you're done with that. Because when you're done with that thing that you're doing, then we can get back to work, you know? But that whole thing, I can't do anything with you when you're like that, you know? And it just waits. And so I feel like when tormented artists like sort of believe that their work comes through the torment, I'm like, no, it comes despite the torment. You know, it's the grass that grows up in the cracks of that cement sidewalk, and that cement is your torment. It's just looking for the angle in.
To come in.
You know, and so once I chose to believe that, mm-hmm. there's nothing to be afraid of, mm-hmm. Except for my own garbage, which I've learned how to identify as being my own. So then I'll apologize. I'll be like, listen, work, sorry, I'm having a little panic, but I know it's got nothing to do with you. And it's like, have at it, you know? When you're done freaking out, let's get back to it, you know? And that seems to work the best way for me.
I'm so glad to hear that, because we want our artists alive. We don't want them tormented, right? We want them to be able to be productive and make these beautiful babies, right?
Yeah, I for one would love some more Dylan Thomas poems. I for one would love another Hemingway novel. Mm. I for one really miss the artists who took themselves out of the world too soon, because there's a hole in the world from the work they never made. Yeah. And you know, there's a hole in the world from all the work that we never make. You know, and I feel like we need to start filling those holes with beauty, 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 as much as we can. Because that's our highest calling, I think.
That's wonderful. Now, does anybody in this audience have a question for Elizabeth?
I think it's so dark. Some questions. I know it's so dark.
You.
Can we turn up some lights?
Beautiful
maybe
people.
You can see?
And hi, everybody over there. I'm so sorry. I'm going to turn myself this way.
Here we go.
You got to look at the back of my head all night. How fun for you.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
I'd like to know kind of concretely about your process from the research portion to writing your outline to day-to-day writing, what that looked like.
Okay, well, I'll tell you how it used to be. When I was an aspiring writer,
and an unpublished writer, I wrote every day. And I think that's what you you absolutely have to do. I'm going to talk into my security. You absolutely have to do that. If nobody's waiting for your work, then you have to be doing it. Because nobody's, I realized very early, no one was ever going to walk up the four flights of stairs in my crummy East Village apartment and knock on the door and say, we understand there's a very talented unpublished writer living here. And you know, we're here to give you your book deal, right? Like, I knew I had to do that. So that's how I wrote a lot in my early years. As my career and my work has evolved, writing has become a seasonal occupation for me. And I think of it, I grew up on a farm, so I think of it sort of in farm seasons. So there's the season for inspiration, which is kind of where I'm at right now, where, like, the ideas are kind of playing ping pong. And then there's the season for commitment, you know, and then then comes the season for research, because everything I do is very heavily researched, and all the preparation. And then comes the season for writing. And that's a very special season, and it's not all the time. And I'm able right now in my life to clear out chunks like that. So it might only be every 3 years, but it'll be 6 months where nothing else is on the calendar, and that's it. And everybody in my life knows that's it, and I very politely try to explain to them that they won't be seeing a lot of me, and I'm terribly sorry, but I'm not going to be able to go to their goddaughter's christening, probably. You know, like, there's just a lot of stuff that has to be put aside. Yeah.
I think we should go to the next question. Thank you so much for that.
Hi, and thank you for this, and thank you for your words of wisdom, both written and spoken. But I wonder, I've been working on a memoir for quite some time, and when you spoke about fighting your work and struggling with your work, one of my big struggles is, what will my family think? Mm. And I really want to move past that, finish this thing, and not care where, you know, I keep looking for a fictional idea to get away from this thing, mm-hmm. but it wants to be born, and I know that, and
they're going to know who they are in your novel anyway, my dear.
Absolutely.
Might as well write a memoir.
Absolutely.
Put it out there.
All right, that's pretty much it.
Actually, sometimes they're even more angry in the novel because they think they're someone else, and then they're like, how could you? You know, it's like, that wasn't even you. It's tricky. It's a really tricky thing, and there are books I haven't written because I don't want to hurt people.
Right.
And so I might not be the best person to advise you, because I know there are memoirists who are a lot more brave than I am. You can't not care.
Well, if you're all dying, and eventually they're all going to be gone, and nobody's going to care.
Oh, you can wait it out.
So I don't want to wait it out, because then I'll be gone. You know, so I got to.
You want
to
be like,
it.
Yeah, Grandma, don't take those blood pressure pills anymore. You know, isn't that terrible? I got to tell you, like, this is where the rubber meets the road here, but. I don't know a single writer who isn't waiting for somebody to die so that they can write, so that there's a story that... We're on, like, a permanent death watch with people. So, I don't know. Don't let that stop you from finishing writing it. And then maybe you want to, like, you know, try it out on the more understanding members of the family. You might also be surprised.
I was just going to say...
People who you think will be furious are often very understanding, and people who you think will be very understanding are often furious.
You have to be...
Memoirs are odd like that.
Thank you for your question.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Let's have a question from this side.
Hi.
Hi, sweetheart. I met you.
How are you? I just wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, your work in terms of short stories and memoirs versus fiction, and how that process kind of comes to you, and how you kind of give it your attention and, you know, address it from your artistic soul.
I think it's interesting. I found that I'm unable to write fiction when I'm living drama. So it's a good sign that I'm writing fiction again. It means my life is quieted down. I can only focus on so much drama at once. And if I'm in it, then I don't have anything left over for imagining other worlds. So there's that difference that I've noted. I think memoir is sort of easier in one respect, because it's essentially reporting. And I was a journalist for a long time, and I find reporting really easy. It's harder in that you have to sort of figure out how you're presenting yourself and others in a real way. Fiction is harder, but I use that word cautiously, because it's also can be way more joyful, and it's way more liberating. I had this at the beginning of the novel. There's this moment where a fictitious character and a real character from history meet for the first time. Henry and Joseph Banks meet, and I was giggling like a schoolgirl when I was writing that, because I had forgotten
the liberties of fiction. I was like, it's like taking a Ken doll and a Godzilla doll and crashing them together. It's like, just because I said so, Henry is now in Joseph Banks's office. You know, like, there's that's really, really thrilling and exciting.
Thank you so much. We'll take one more over here.
Okay.
Right. Hi.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself as a reader and how you've evolved and, you know, how what you read influences your writing and what you're currently reading right now?
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, generally as a reader, it's really simple. I just wrote a 19th century novel. I read 19th century novels. So those are my people. Dickens, Eliot, Austen, Trollope, Henry James, the Brontes, that's my team. And if I could read nothing else for the rest of my life, I would just read them again and again and again and again. And their influence, I think, shows up in my fiction, not so much in my nonfiction. I don't think you would see it in my nonfiction, but you see it in my fiction. You know, you're not winning a prize if you say that this novel feels Dickensian. And what am I reading?
Any contemporary authors at all?
Yeah, I mean, there's many that I like. I like, I can never think of them at these moments, but here we go. I like Michael Chabon. I like the people who write the big, daring things. I love Hilary Mantel. Wolf Hall, I think, is the best novel of the last 10, if not 20 years. I also love her earlier stuff, which is completely different and totally worth looking into, may I say. I love some of our living poets. Sharon Olds is somebody who's really important to me. My favorite poet, Jack Gilbert, just died last year, but his work is a real touchstone to me. You know, on the self-help side, I like me my Pema Chodron. I like my Buddhists. I like Jack Kornfield. That's my gang.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wait, should we go over the side?
Sure. I am totally on the, like, flaky, girly, arty train with you, and I noticed your really cute outfit as you walked out here, so I'm wondering, you know, what does fashion, or what role does fashion play in your research, in your writing, or just, like, as a fan, as a girl, like, how do you work with that?
That's so cute. Okay, two nights ago, I did an event in California with a woman who is a writer who I really, really, really admire, named Kelly Corrigan, wrote a book called The Middle Place that was a bestseller. And it was, we had such a good time. We had met at the Book Expo of America last summer, and we had this really great eye-to-eye, like, you're a serious woman, I'm a serious woman, you're a literary person, I'm a literary person conversation, you know, like, just firing at all cylinders. And all of a sudden I looked down and I was like, holy shit, what are those shoes? You know, like, I just completely freaked out. She's like, they're Tory Burch. I'm like, where'd you get them? You know, they were crazy. They had all these beads on them and they were like 4 inches high. And it was like our sort of fake serious masks came off and this other, and at the end of our event, she like presented me with those shoes because we have the same size feet.
Cool.
It was so great.
So
and I was like,
nice.
See, you can be a serious woman and also kind of care about other people's shoes.
Notice the shoes, by the way. Cute, no?
We're not supposed to care about that kind of stuff, but I think it is a kind of expression as well. Thumbs up. And it's very funny because as you were stepping up, I was about to say, that is a great jacket. And then I thought that would be really shallow, but that is a great jacket.
Yeah. Thank you. Should we go this side?
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
My name is Patricia. I'm from Brazil as well.
Oh,
and
oi,
we have
querida.
A lot of friends there. Oi, querida. And my question is, you always say about finding equilibrium between your worldly pleasures and spiritual life. And I would like to know, first, if that's possible, and second, if you found it.
No, I haven't found it. It's probably possible. I mean, I find it every once in a while. I got to tell you, the question was about finding equilibrium between pleasure and a spiritual life. That's kind of what I set out to do in Eat, Pray, Love, and it is what I kind of set out to do all the time. I got to tell you, I am now a little bit anti the word balance. It's a word that I feel like is starting to become a weapon that women use against themselves. Another thing that we haven't achieved. And I see it everywhere, and it's very aspirational. It's in every interview, in every women's magazine. It's in every page of every issue of every women's magazine. And I feel like it's starting to be a mean word for us. Because all it does is make you feel bad that you haven't gotten it. And it also sort of sets up this idea that there are people who have, you know,
I've got it.
Right? First of all, I don't even want to be friends with that person. Because they're probably an asshole. You know? Like, who is that? Like, I don't even know who that is. That's not anybody I know. You know? And so I feel like, I don't know, I feel like self-forgiveness is a lot more important than the constant striving for something that I'm not even sure is entirely possible. Also, I think that balance, you know, I went to a liberal arts college, so I took a circus class once. balance, you know, and I took a circus class, I learned how to walk on a tightrope, and I remember the guy saying, breaking down the word equilibrium, you know, equal freedom, it means the equal freedom to fall in any direction. And so what happens is that oftentimes you do, you know, because you're like, and a point of balance is just that one moment where you don't happen to be falling at that moment, you know, and that's a really great thing. And when you're in that moment, that's fantastic. But the next moment you topple over, right? And then you get back and you get it again. And then you topple over and then you get back and you get it again. And you topple over and you get it back. And that process and learning to sort of be okay with the reality of that is, I think, better for us than just constantly being fixated on holding that. Because you hold that, and then the ground under you shifts, right? And so you fall, and then you get back, and the ground shifts again. We live in a really it's a slippery proposition being a person. You know, just when you think you got it, it's like, whoa, earthquake, you know? So I think I've just gotten better at so kind of being cool with that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question, sweetheart.
Good question.
She got it, Slay.
Thanks. Hi there.
Hello.
This is in the same vein as, like, the struggle thing that you were mentioning with your characters, but I'm just really wondering if you ever experience a resistance and how you manage that.
I experience resistance all the time. Let me get that straight. All the time. And creatively, I experience it all the time. I've just done it long enough that I know what it is, and I know what it isn't. And I actually think that what helped me a lot creatively was all that meditation that I don't do anymore. All that meditation.
I was going to ask you that. Yeah, no more.
Oh. I mean, so when I say I don't do it, what I mean is I make all kinds of promises that I'm going to do it. And I do it for like 2 days and then I don't do it for like 2 months. But you should do it. I hope you are all.
Because you're balanced.
Because you have the balance, you see.
Right.
So I'm still striving on that. So in the same way that it took me 4 months in silence and meditation in India to finally figure out that the demons that I had been fighting in my mind, that horrible neighborhood you would never want to walk alone in at night that is my mind, those demons and villains and, you know, hostage takers who live in my mind are not monsters. They're just toddlers. It really took me a long time to figure that out. Mm. And once I realized that, I was like, oh, my God, they're toddler orphans. You know, they're pathetic street urchins. Like, I thought they were like horrible gangs. But they're just like scared little tiny critters.
TLC.
Who only need reassurance to go quiet. You know, and my fighting them, fight a toddler, see what happens, right? Like, my fighting them only made them more enraged, more scared, more kicky, more fierce, more bitey, more grabby, more desperate, more needy, you know? And when I got to that point, I wrote about that in Me Pray Love, when I got to that point where I was like, just come into my heart. You're all welcome. I'm not going to kick any of you out of this house. That's what they're afraid of. They're just afraid they're going to get kicked out of the house. You're never going back to the orphanage. Like, you're all coming with me. I have enough love for all of you. I know you're all part of me. And the other metaphor I often use is it's the big minivan of our minds. They're never getting out. You know what I mean?
Just in there.
Like, the more you try to throw them out of the minivan, the uglier that drive gets, you know? They will not be leaving the minivan. Every, like, monster, demon, orphan in your head is going to be with you your whole life. It's just that I've realized there's this higher person, this wiser, calmer, more loving person of great capacity who's driving that minivan. And what I just do is I just turn around and say, like, mommy's driving, you know? And I do that when I'm writing because they come up and they tell me that I'm washed up. They tell me that I'm a fraud. They tell me that I'm a failure. They tell me that I'm done. They tell me that I was never any good. They tell me that it was a fluke. Like, I mean, they tell me all that stuff that they tell all of us. And I just say to them, thank you. I really appreciate your contribution. I know that your job is to disrupt. I don't really know why that's your job, but apparently that's your job. You're doing a great job. You're doing it great. But mommy's driving. And you don't get to drive this car. Because you drove this car long enough and you drove it so poorly. You like drove us off the road. So we said, you don't get to drive. Mommy's driving. And mommy's life is short. I live in her human time. And there are things she wants to get done before she dies. So just why don't you guys just go play video games and let me work? And it seems to work. You know, so there's like a gentleness that's required to deal with that. And I feel like that's the mistake that the great battling Norman Mailers of the world made, was like coming up bloody against those things isn't doing you any good, you know? So
love and kindness.
Love and kindness.
I love that.
I don't always succeed at it, but I try.
Another one over here.
Hi. I just want to quickly make a comment before my question. My husband, who's 18 years older than I am, and who thought Eat, Pray, Love was a little bit of a woman's book.
Eat, Pray, Love, a woman's book?
He was
radical.
He was encouraged by me to listen to Eat, Pray, Love, read by you, on a little trip from New Jersey to Savannah, and he loved it.
Oh, thank you.
He was converted.
I know a lot of men who've had that book read to them in bed by their wives. It's nice that you let them have the audio tape.
You read it too. I'm just really interested in how your writing process in Eat, Pray, Love, because you had all these little tales, and they're all different, and how you piece them together, and how you did like the flashbacks, but they're interwoven. How you did that? Because it's fascinating, I think.
The structuring of it, I didn't know how to do that till I had the realization to write it like the Japa Mala beads that I write about. And for those of you who haven't read Eat, Pray, Love, I'm looking at all the men in the audience now. The book is structured around the model of a Japa Mala rosary bead, which is something they use in India for meditation, which is a bead that it's a string of beads that always has 108 beads on it. And I was using one a lot when I was in India, so I was really aware of that number. And then I realized it's divided into threes very easily, into 36. And I just thought, I want this book to be balanced even in its telling. So I'm going to make each section of the book, Italy, India, and Indonesia, 36 chapters. And those chapters can be a paragraph long, or they can be several pages long. And once I had that, it was kind of paint by numbers, fill in the blanks. I came home with thousands of pages of notes. And I went to an artist residency, and I only read through them once. And I just said, this is going to be a huge act of trust. I'm not going to overthink this. I'm going to read through this, and the anecdotes that I think are good, I'm going to circle, and the rest of it I'm never going to look at again, ever. And I thought the faster I do that, the purer this is going to be. You know, because the more I double think, triple think, quadruple think, the messier this is going to get. So let's just do it. So I just went through like, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And then I took all those pieces that I liked, and I built the book out of that.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Another question over here?
Hi, Liz, how are you?
Do you guys have a question together?
Well, we kind of wanted to...
Are you going to sing a duet? I'm trying to figure out...
I can! If you're feeling sad and lonely... Oh, gosh, she left me. I'm supposed to be moral support up here.
Oh, she left me. I was curious about the arrangement, the collaboration.
Actually, both of us were reporters in Litchfield County.
Oh, hello, Litchfield County. Hometown.
Nice.
So, but my question was, I'm considering writing a novel. I'm not sure if I'm going to do fiction or if I'm going to do a memoir. Uh-huh. What are some advice you can relay to me about thinking about?
If I asked you right now, which one would be more interesting, fiction or nonfiction, what would you say?
Nonfiction.
Well, then you should probably write that one.
Okay.
And when I say interesting, I don't mean for the reader, I mean for the writer.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you're going to have to entertain yourself while you're doing this. So I guess that's what you should do. Do it. You know, women especially have a problem, I think, holding themselves back and holding their work back. Because they don't think that what they have to say is important. Mm-hmm. They think somebody else already said it better. It's a familiar story. Nobody's ever going to buy it. Have I left out any? I'm going to be judged. I'm going to be criticized. I'm not good enough. And like, just add your own things. I can't urge you strongly enough to push against that. Because First of all, no one ever read your version of that story, whatever that story is, mm-hmm. which I guarantee you is different mm-hmm. from other people's. No one's ever read your voice. Mm-hmm. And also, any talent that you have that you don't use becomes a burden on your life, mm-hmm. and it will haunt you. And if you have gifts that you're not using, and you have stories that you're not telling, they will weigh on you so heavily mm-hmm. that it will cause you pain and suffering, and I don't want that for you. So open up to it, and then put it out there in the world.
Look to Thank it. You. Part two. Now I did think of something. So I write. I write all damn day, but I'm not writing a thing for myself. Uh-huh. I'm writing for my readers. That's what I'm doing. I'm writing stuff on Facebook. I'm writing things on Twitter, and I'm writing these little snippets for all my readers. Uh-huh. At the end of the day, I don't want to write for myself. I don't, but I do. Right. Feel me? How can I tell myself, shut the fuck up and write?
Well, I don't think that you necessarily have to quit your job.
Oh, that's not an option.
You know, so if you believe that it's impossible for you to write because you're also writing, I do not believe that that is the reason that you're not writing.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm calling you out on that.
Hit
Red.
Me.
I'm calling you out.
Go ahead.
Because a lot, you know, it's been shown that that can be done. You know, and you may have to dedicate. You may have to like start being very disciplined about dedicating certain hours of the day or certain days of the week to that work. Mm-hmm. Like really committing to that. Sundays are for this. Twitter goes off, Facebook goes off, phone goes off, Breaking Bad goes off, everything goes. You know, And allowing yourself that, and believing that that's possible. It's so possible. Guys, Toni Morrison was an editor at Random House. So not only did she have a full-time job and she was a single mother, but she was reading other people's manuscripts and editing other people. This is beyond me. I can't even imagine that. Forever. She would spend 8-10 hours a day reading other people's manuscripts. And then she decided, I guess that she didn't want to go to her grave burdened by what she had not said. And she started getting up at 4:30 in the morning to work on her book before she went to work. So that her work got the worst part of her brain. You know what I mean? You're right now dedicating your best energies to your job. Slack. You know? Set your alarm for an hour earlier. Go to bed an hour earlier. And do the work in the morning. She's like, that's never going to happen.
I know. I'm already thinking how much coffee I'm going to be buying. I'm like, all right, I can do this.
But you know what? I had a yoga teacher once who said to me, what are you willing to give up to have what you really want?
Yeah. I gotcha.
You know?
Thank you.
And for me, that was staying up past 9 o'clock at night, which I don't do unless I'm on book tour. Because I finally did the math that there's no way I'm ever going to be a book writer if I go to bed late. It just isn't going to happen. And so all kinds of things got lost in that. A whole bunch of socializing, a whole bunch of movies I want to see, a whole bunch of, like, good cheer and humanity. And I'm in bed at 9 o'clock. Mm. And I gave that up because what I really want is to be a writer.
Thank you.
Last couple of questions.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
I'm Allison. We met earlier.
Yes, we did.
I have two questions for you. The first is, in describing your practice of writing, I'm almost thinking of an artist at a painting. Things come to you, and it's in you. It's in your soul. So what I'm wondering is, as a child, did you really know you had this passion and desire to write? Is this almost like a gift? I mean, if you believe in a God, whatever, it's really... Seems like it was really a gift that you're born with.
Do you guys know what talent means, the word?
Yeah.
I mean, but where it comes from? Your talent is your payment. In Roman army, when you got paid, you got your talent. Everybody gets paid something. You know, it's your bag of silver. Everyone is given one.
Right. It's just finding what
you know,
it is.
And it's also, it's figuring out what it is, and it's also figuring out how you're going to spend it. You can blow it on hookers and cocaine,
yeah.
You know, or you can invest it in doing beautiful work, or you can bury it in the garden and never use it because you're afraid of it, or you can give it to people who don't deserve it, because you all you know how to do is leak things that are good to people who are bad. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that you can do with the payment that you were given,
yeah.
The talent that you were given. I knew I had this thing because I could tell, and I could also tell because of all the stuff I wasn't good at. You know, and I'm not being facetious, but I'm not, like, I took piano lessons for 9 years. You put me in front of a piano, I can play you literally nothing. You know, all my parents' money was wasted on that. I took gymnastics forever. I am not a gymnast. I am not a dancer. I am not a singer. I am not a visual artist. And it is not because I was not exposed to these things.
Right.
I am not scientific. I am not mathematical. I am not particularly punctual. I am not... A good surfer, like you know, just yeah. add to it.
Yeah.
This thing, for some reason, from a very early age, when I did it, people drew near. You know,
and, you knew it.
And on the playground, even before I could read and write, kids wanted me to make up the story that we were going to play. You know, and that's been it. And so I invested everything in that. And I'm not going to have you a second question because I want these people to get their question. But thank you so much.
Thank you, hi, Elizabeth. I thank you for Alma and Prudence and Henry. Really cool.
Thank you.
Will you be reading this for an audio?
I didn't read it. I've read I read Eat, Pray, Love, and I read Committed. I don't read my fiction because I'm not a good enough actor, and I feel like those books need, this book in particular needed an actress because it's got so many different voices, so many different accents, so many different scenes, and I don't know if anyone has heard it yet, but Juliet Stevenson, the great British stage actress, has read it already.
Wonderful.
And it's already available. And actually, just today on Salon.com, Laura Miller wrote a review of the audiobook saying it's spectacular. Because Juliet Stevenson, for those of you who don't know her,
she
read all the Jane Austen books. She read all the George Eliot books. She's read all the Bronte stuff.
Wonderful.
And her voice was the voice in my head when I was writing this book. And I was lucky enough to get her.
So,
yeah. Let's take our last. I don't want to send this person away from the microphone. So,
hello, Elizabeth. You spoke of having note cards and then being able to write over a period of 4 months, I think you said. But going back to those note cards and the process, in reading the book, there were so many revelations and sudden twists. I know you spoke of Alma coming to you. And how did the story come to you?
The story comes in the research. That's how, and I think part of the reason I suffered in my 20s as a writer, especially as a writer of fiction, is I did not know how to help myself by preparation. When I think of myself in my 20s sitting down to write fiction, it was like this. Liz sits down, opens up a notebook, and is like, my book. Gonna write a book by Elizabeth Gilbert. Page one of my book. You know, and I had given myself nothing. I mean, it was like I was going to the Olympics, you know, after having spent like 10 years watching TV. Like, I had nothing. You know, and so of course I suffered, because of course I don't know what this thing is, you know, and so I've learned over time, and I think journalism taught me that, and writing nonfiction taught me that, that the story comes to you in the preparation for the story. And so all those 3 years of writing and research and taking notes, the characters came through me through other real characters in life. So I'm reading like thousands of Victorian era letters, and I'm starting to hear voices, and I'm starting to hear pieces of people. Oh, Prudence could be like that. Oh, when Hanukkah is stern, it's because she's sort of like this person from this 18th century journal that I read who complains about how she doesn't understand why people celebrate New Year's Eve because the New Year comes whether you celebrate it or not, right? Like, that's a wonderful little detail. This is a wonderful little detail. This could be Henry. Here's, you know, and you start to build it, and those note cards just build and build and build. And then you do the outline. And so for me, the difference in the way I write now and the way I wrote when I was 22 is that when I was 22, it's like I walked into a big house that was fully furnished, a bunch of kids lived in, and I was like, I'm going to paint the inside of this house. You know, opened up a can of paint and started painting a wall, and then I'm like, oh, there's a picture here. Oh, there's a couch here. Oh, there's somebody's toys are here. Oh, but nobody's cleaned. You know, and now when I do it, that house is ready to be painted when I get to work writing. Like, all the furniture's been moved out. All the windows have been taped. All the walls have been sanded down. You know, and all I have to do now is roll the paint in large strokes. And that's how it works for me. I would no more punish myself by sitting down to write a book without extensive preparation than I would run a marathon now.
So thank you all so much for your
so much.